Did any of you catch yourself in that song going like, whoa, wait, is this really what I want? Like, shake up the ground, like, make room for God to work. You're like, wait, wait, what does that mean, right? I love that song, and I think it's very appropriate to our talk, actually, this morning. Happy New Year. Great to be with you guys all. Love that idea of a fresh start. Probably some of you are with me on that. Like, 2024, you're like, oh, okay, you know, kind of categorize that. Like, it was sort of mid. Like, hopefully there was good things in there and probably some bad things in there. But a fresh start, I think, is always a good feeling for us. You know, before I get into it, I have one more announcement to add to Patty's list. Going into a new year, we have elder nominations that take place during this time. And we have two people nominated. And I'm excited about these. I'm always excited about our elder nominations, but these two are like young elders, so to speak. The two people that have been nominated for this year by our committee are Chad Morrison, yeah, who is not here, I believe, and Richard Medina, who is here in the front row or second row here. And we tell you this ahead of time so that you can have the next couple weeks to interrogate them properly. Make sure that they fit the bill. I just have loved getting to know Richard over the last few years. And he's just been such a key part of our young adults ministry and kind of an old soul. He's a therapist. He brings those kind of perspectives and qualifications there. And just delighted at that. So anyway. So anyway, process that, pray about that, and you'll get your opportunity to vote in a couple weeks. But a new year, a fresh start. We have begun this tradition now. This was our second year of, after New Year's, going up to Yosemite. We've got some friends up there that are some of your friends too. Scott and Natalie live up in Mariposa, and had a chance to go back into the valley. I love it. Kind of off season. It's like, still, it's vacation time, but it's cold up there, and it's like such a beautiful time to me to be in the valley. We kind of sneak into the Awani and like bring our snacks in. Don't tell anybody, but I love that old hotel. It's just so beautiful and kind of cozy up by the fire. This year, we had done this hike, and coming down, you finish at this little campground there that's called Camp 4. Has anybody been in Camp 4? So if you're a climber, this is like rich history right here. This is where the dirtbags lived. And that sounds condescending, but it's not. If you were a climber in this certain area, dirtbag was like, you carried that title with pride. They would live there in this like little campground and kind of avoid the rangers all summer. And these guys were just incredible climbers. And I took Mia there to see this one boulder problem that's called Midnight Lightning. And it actually has what some might consider graffiti on the rock, this lightning bolt that's there, that's like, it's actually like a piece of art, because this is probably the most famous boulder problem in the world. And it was what they would call like a test piece. If you wanted to be in this group, they called themselves the Stone Masters. You had to climb this route, and when we were there, somebody was trying it and almost got it. And you know, I'm thinking about New Year's resolutions, and I'm remembering back a time in my life where that might have been sort of on a future possible road for Jeff. Like, maybe someday I could do Midnight Lightning. And realizing at my age, you're like, some of those resolutions, that's over. That's like never going to happen. As I'm watching this guy on this precarious last move, and he's probably 20, and, you know, ends up falling off of this thing, and you just go, there's certain things that I just go, at this point in my life, it's not going to happen. I'm just too old for this, right? So you sort of adjust these resolutions as you go. There's certain hopes and dreams that at a certain point you're like, ah, okay, reality has this way of setting in. As I think about this coming year, right, our resolutions kind of age with us and hopefully are refining over the years. Certain things that we once thought, oh, that's a goal, we're letting go. Maybe some of you are rediscovering some of those goals and going, actually, that's not over yet. Maybe I do want to step in more fully into this. Maybe I do want to write a book or change my career or step into an area that is new. And the truth is, God has these kind of goals and aspirations for our lives, sometimes more than we do. that oftentimes in our life, we're setting goals that feel realistic and achievable, and oftentimes God is asking us to dream bigger dreams. And as we go into this year, we've been studying the book of Hebrews, and we find ourselves in a section of this that I was thinking, you know, as we were kind of going through the lectionary kind of lovingly gives you different passages that you could select. And today's is probably one that if you were given this as an opportunity, you probably wouldn't preach. It's on the priesthood. And in some ways, we come across this and go, oh, gosh, how relevant does this feel? How many of us really feel like we need a priest? And the truth is, as I'm reading this passage, I'm thinking, gosh, this feels actually more relevant than ever. The answer is, all of us do. Every single one of us needs a priest. And I was thinking that's maybe what I would title this today, Why You Need a Priest. And kind of a maybe subtitle would be, Why Self-Help Will Never Be Enough. And our passage here begins kind of at the midpoint of chapter 7 in Hebrews. And we've got the words up there for you. I'm just going to read it. And you're going to get what I'm saying, I think, pretty quick. You're like, okay, this is just theology. You feel like you're reading a theology text here on the role of priest. But as it pertains to Jesus, and as it pertains to this kind of new order that's really an old order, that Jesus is a part of a separate lineage, this order of Melchizedek, right? And we talked about this last week. It's coming from this obscure Old Testament reference in Genesis to this king who shows up and who blesses Abraham and serves him bread and wine, coincidentally, interestingly, and who Abraham tithes back to, somebody of a different lineage than the people of Israel. Somebody who comes in and performs this blessing to the people who will then become the blessing. So, let's start here. In verse 11, chapter 7 of Hebrews, it says this, "Now if perfection came through the Levitical priesthood, for on the basis of it the people received the law, what further need was there for another priest to appear, said to be according to the order of Melchizedek, and not according to the order of Aaron? For when there's a change of priesthood, there must be a change of law as well. For the one of these things are spoken about belongs to a different tribe. No one from it has served at the altar. Now it is evident that our Lord came from Judah, and Moses said nothing about that tribe concerning priests. And this becomes clearer if another priest like Melchizedek appears, who did not become a priest based on legal regulation about physical descent, but based on the power of an indestructible life. For it has been testified, you are a priest according to the order of Melchizedek. So the previous command is annulled because it was weak and unprofitable, for the law perfected nothing, but a better hope is introduced through which we draw near to God. None of this happened without an oath, for others became priests without an oath, but he became a priest with an oath made by the one who said to him, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever. Because of this oath, Jesus has also become the guarantee of a better covenant. Now many have become Levitical priests since they are prevented by death from remaining in office. But because he remains forever, he holds his priesthood permanently. Therefore, he is able to save completely those who come to God through him, since he always lives to intercede for them. For this is the kind of high priest we need, holy, innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. He doesn't need to offer sacrifices every day as high priests do, first for their own sins, then those of the people. He did this once for all time when he offered himself. For the law appoints as high priests men who are weak, but the promise of the oath, which came after the law, appoints a son who has been perfected forever." Amen. The word of the Lord. Now, there's a lot in there. Crazy to think this was a sermon, right? This is so dense. I'm like kind of amazed that people could process just your everyday sitting in the pew. They would listen to that and be like, good point, right? It reminds me a little bit. Like, I love how Mere Christianity with these radio broadcasts, and that people were like turning off the music in the bars so that they could listen to Lewis, you know, reading these transcripts, and to go, wow, it came at a really high level. These people were focused in, and in some ways maybe better at this than we are. But Hebrews is addressing this deep need, a need to become, as our translation says here today, perfected. But this is a word where in Greek, it reflects this like proper end of our life, this completion, this maturity. That there's this goal for our lives, this idea of a proper end. And if we aren't giving ourselves properly to this task, all of us have this tendency to not reach this goal, to not reach this perfection, this finished work. And it turns out this finished work requires a priest, but not just any priest. There was a system given, these Levitical priests that would come and they would provide an opportunity for there to be temporary forgiveness from sin, to pay for our debts. They would usher people into the presence of God. They would act as an intercessor. And this is kind of the main role of priest, is this intercessor between God and man. That relationship is broken and there's this need for a bridge. And why do we need this thing? You know, I was thinking, why do we need a priest? And immediately was thinking of Robert De Niro. There's a quote from him, and I'm blanking on the movie, but it might be Godfather 3, where he says, like, if I get a hold of you, you're not going to need a doctor. You're going to need a priest. Right? What does he mean by that, right? Like, a doctor's only going to get you so far, right? You're going to need somebody to pray over your body at some point, right? These are the mafia, right? And this idea that the truth is for all of us that at some point in our life, we're not going to need a doctor. We're going to need a priest. That all of our lives have a limited span. All of our lives have a limited number of days. I heard somebody say recently, all of our lives are like an ice cube melting. And as we go into a new year, this realization comes as we set goals that there's a sort of time limit for all of us, a limited amount of days, and there comes an end, and a necessary end to keep in mind, that at some point we need a priest. And I think we live in this world where most people would deny that need, right? They're chasing after other things. Their goals are set, some sort of self-improvement, self-betterment. And this is a good thing, I think. It comes from a good place. But the danger is, I think, so much of our society is running from this idea of a limited, finite life. I remember when Nietzsche famously said, God is dead. He followed it up by saying, once God is dead, what we will worship is health. That will become our religion. That will become the thing we worship. And I just looked up this statistic out of curiosity, but the world spent $75 billion last year in anti-aging products. $75 billion to look younger, right? That's not even health related. That's not even like supplements or, you know, these kind of things or a fitness program. These are just ways to look, to fool those around us and maybe even to fool ourselves. Maybe, just maybe, I'm the one person that can beat the odds and avoid death and live forever. And this is going to affect the way we look at the goals of our life, the end, the perfection. What does that look like for us? Well, if we're denying death and we're just seeking this sort of unending self-improvement, it's going to affect the goals that we set. It's going to affect these resolutions. And, you know, self-help, to me, it's a massive industry, right? If they didn't come up with a self-help category, there would be no other nonfiction. Right? This, it would just get obliterated, right? That if you put self-help into nonfiction, they're the only ones that sell books, are the self-help. They ended up pulling that out as a separate category so that the other nonfiction writers would have a chance at some sort of bestseller, right? Because there's like no comparison. We are hungry for self-help. We are hungry for improvement. But the ones that present wisdom are the ones that push us to think about the end. I think Stephen Covey in, you know, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, he's going to say, begin with the end in mind. What do you want this to look like at the end? David Brooks, I think he did a wonderful job in his book on, is it the one on The Road to Character, where he talks about living a life based on your eulogy, not your resume. They bring this end into perspective because it has a way of speaking into our current goals and revealing them, oftentimes for the smallness of what we're seeking after and the brokenness of what we're pursuing. I've mentioned this before, but there's a EMT that did a TED Talk. His name was Matthew O'Reilly. And he talked about how when he would come on the scene and meet somebody that was going to die, that was often their question, am I going to die? And that he said for the longest time he would lie and say no. He thought maybe that would be the most comforting to them, that they would be able to like pretend that they were going to be okay. And at some point his conscience wouldn't let him. And so he found himself saying, as this person is laying there and they're bleeding out or they don't have much time, and they said, am I going to die? He would say yes. And he's saying it was interesting. There was like often a moment of shock, but then a sort of calmness would set in. And then he would say, and this is somebody who saw this time and time again, they would ask for one of three things. They would need to express some sort of regret. They would admit this desire to be forgiven. Or they would be concerned that they wouldn't be remembered. And I thought, isn't that interesting when you think about this? And this is not to be morbid. Hopefully this doesn't feel morbid. It's just thinking properly about our life and to go, what are those things at the end of life that seem to matter? As Stephen Covey says, consider the end, right? To understand this idea that most people, when they get to the end, there's a sense of like what they could have done different. A realization that they've actually done some harm in their life. Broken relationships, done things to others that they wish they could undo. And then this deep longings for some sort of legacy or permanence that their life mattered and wouldn't just be forgotten. And I think these kind of exercises for us in considering the end, right? This is where you need a priest. And it's interesting to think of this first responder sitting there in many ways in a priestly role with these people. But does that person have what it takes to usher you across to address those things? I think for some people, there was a peace just in being heard. But the truth is, these express greater needs and longings than we sometimes want to admit. Are we taking these things into consideration as we go into this next year? Or are we instead going back into those small dreams? I love how Nouwen says there's these three misguided lies that we buy into through our life. That number one, that I am what I have, right? Who are you? Well, I'm the one who owns this house or drives this car or wears this whatever, right? This is what gives me my identity. Or, kind of similar to the resume, I am what I do. Here's where I went to school. Here's the job that I've had. Here's the list of things that show you how important I am. In some ways, not possession in this case, but somehow my influence or power, the respect that I carry. And that's kind of the last one. I am what people say about me. My popularity, right? My influence. How much of a splash do I make when I say something? And I think at death, these things become kind of silly, don't they? What you own, what you do, what people think. And there's this moment, I think, of freedom that we're invited to as we think about this. That death invites us to somehow stop playing these silly games, to stop right now. There's a sort of gravity that's pulling us into this place of constant comparison, judging our lives based on those around us. This gravity that if we don't resist it, it pulls us down. That the only way for us to kind of gain this freedom is to defy gravity, which would be a great song title, don't you think? I'm going to write that down. Defying Gravity. I don't know if you've seen Wicked, but there's this song in there, right? And I bring this up. I haven't seen the movie. I will. But Lila and I, I would drive her to school at El Moro, and it was like no surprise for Lila. It was like show tunes, full volume, all the way, singing wholehearted. This is my little girl, you know. But that one would come on, and there's this line at the beginning that to me, like, it's kind of embarrassing to admit. Like, if you want to make Jeff cry, just play the beginning of this song where, like, probably make me choke up now, where Glinda says, "Don't be afraid." And Elphaba goes, "I'm not. The wizard should be afraid of me." It's like so strong, right? Like to go, here's this small little wizard pulling these people into this small little world where they're all so afraid of each other. And this power to like fight that. That this empowerment, I mean, I think this is self-help at its best, right? Just goes, no, I don't want to live that small life, right? This pushing back against this thing, this taking responsibility. Patty and I were listening to this self-help book on our way up because, you know, we're going to pick something to read. And I was like, I'm kind of a fan of Mel Robbins. I don't know. Maybe it's just that she comes on and goes, "Hey, it's your friend Mel." And I'm like, "Hey, Mel." I'm like, "Love you." She wrote this book. It's called Let Them. And I'll be honest, like, I can give you the book in like 2 seconds, right? She's just going, this is your response to any point of comparison. And takes it as far as like anybody that speaks down on you, anybody that's got some wrong opinion of you, anybody that is critical or judgmental, she goes, let them. I'm like, oh gosh, if I could only, right? Let them think that. Why are you trying to control that? Let them. And she's going, that little bit of freedom, and this is not hers, right? This is like every Stoic philosopher has said this, right? From all time, but I like, she captures it in this simple little way. Like, just like let go of these games, these comparisons, this like worrying about, oh, I was left out of that thing, or why wasn't I invited to that party, or look at all those people having a great time without me, or look at that person's success, and now I feel terrible about my life, and blah, blah, blah. Like, all this stuff, she's just going, like, oh, let them. And then she goes, then let me, right, go, what are my values? What are the things that I hold to? This sort of taking back possession of what we actually can control instead of worrying about all this stupid stuff that we can't. And I'm like, thank you, Mel. It's hard work. It's part of the maturity. It's where, to me, self-help is beneficial. And you're going to be like, whoa, wait, Jeff, like, self-help, isn't that dangerous? And I would go, well, it needs to be qualified. But the truth is, and this is getting back to our text, self-help isn't bad. It's too small. It's not enough. But this growth into our proper end requires some effort. It just requires the right sort of effort. In 2 Timothy, Paul's going to say, share in suffering as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No one serving as a soldier gets entangled in the concerns of civilian life. He seeks to please the commanding officer. Also, if anyone competes as an athlete, he's not crowned unless he competes according to the rules. This idea of going, this process requires effort. Like Dallas Willard would say, effort not earning. You're not earning your place in God's kingdom. You're not proving to God you have value. But there's this thing that drags us into this place of like smallness and complacency. And that God has given us, in some ways, a self-help book. And it comes through the law. It comes in and reveals that we're broken. It comes in and says there's a standard of righteousness. There is a way of behaving. One that calls us to a life that is greater and larger and more purposeful. That is our future. That is what the Torah brings. It brings a vision for our lives that is larger than we so often go after. The danger of self-help is that none of us can do it. I was reading this about our resolutions, and it was saying, you know, like 1 week later, 25% of people have like already lost their resolution for the year. 1 week, right? And you're like, they just cut out 25% gone. By the end of a month, like 46% are done. But like the rest are still going. 6 months later, that kind of flip-flops. It's like only 46% of people at 6 months are still doing it. By the end of the year, less than 10% have successfully maintained their resolutions. But if it's like pull yourself up by your bootstraps, like we're in trouble. We don't have it. And this is in some ways kind of the gift of the law, as it holds this standard out. But if we seek after it, we're going to fail. The only people that think that they're actually achieving the law are the ones that are still in that comparison game, right? They're looking at everybody else and being like, at least I'm not doing what that guy's doing. But if we let that law speak into our lives, it shows us where we fall short. It shows us where we're broken. And that law was given to the people of Israel when they had no sort of identity. They just were lost. They were coming out of slavery. And that law said, this is who you are. You are my people. And this is the way my people behave. We'd say that from time to time to our children. This is going to sound so like cocky to say, but we'd be like, hey, you're Tacklins, right? Like, this is how Tacklins behave. Why aren't we doing this thing? Well, because this is what we do. This is what we've chosen to do. And in many ways, this is what the Torah gave, is this sense of identity to a people that had none. They didn't know who they were. They were living in slavery. But our text today says this previous command is annulled because it was weak and unprofitable, for the law perfected nothing. And what is the author of Hebrews saying there? Well, it pointed out some things, but this weak or unprofitable, it's maybe a little harsh. I could see Moses going like, hey, come on. That's a pretty good, right? But this idea of we're called to this system of righteousness, but the weakness of the law is it wasn't enough to make us so. And that you had this system of priests that was in there trying to perpetuate this sort of cleansing for the people, but it was this ongoing thing. This perfection was constantly eluding us. We still found ourselves full of flaws, still in need for more. This idea of what preceded it, it's not to say, I think sometimes we think like, the law's out now, and now we've got the new covenant. And you go, well, it built on itself. That God's goals for you aren't less than self-help, they're greater than. In Matthew 5:17, Jesus says, don't think I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. That vision behind it, of reaching full maturity, of being in this place where the brokenness is fully mended, where our life is fully healed. This is still the goal, but now we have something greater, a greater promise, a priest who comes not from this lineage of broken priests, weak human priests. Well, here's what it says in Hebrews. The law appoints as high priests men who are weak, that's me, but the promise of the oath which came after the law appoints a son, who's been perfected forever. Remember this, that the Hebrews is about the uniqueness of Christ, how he meets a whole different standard, that he comes in and provides something that is actually able to get us across the line, that as we reach that end point of life and find ourselves on the brink, at the veil, a priest who can take us across. I'm glad this takes some pressure off of me as a pastor to think that I somehow need to be adequate for this task. It comes in and reassures, like, Jeff's just another man in this journey, just another broken priest, just another weak priest. That the power is not going to be my presence at your death. The presence that you need is one greater. But that we have this priest And as a result of it, we have this hope, a better hope, as our text says, with which we are able to draw near to God. And it turns out this is the actual brokenness deep within us, this separation from God, which is something we chose for ourselves. It's something that we desired, that we were given all the way back in the beginning, this opportunity to separate, and we chose that. And so everything we do, even if we're pursuing religious things, if we're pursuing them in our broken way, we turn them into systems of self-promotion, self-worship, opportunities to judge others, to perpetuate that. And that song that we sing today is like, break all that up, God. Break up all that religion. What does that mean? It's just a spiritual self-help program that we then use to compare ourselves to everybody else. This is what we're being set free from. This is what we're battling against. But that we have this high priest that is calling us to more. And as it turns out, who's somebody that's able to get us there. I love how in our text it says, this becomes clearer in verse 15, if another priest like Melchizedek appears, who did not become a priest based on a legal regulation about physical descent, like his lineage, but on the power of an indestructible life. And this is what we see in Jesus, this life that comes in humility and in meekness, a life who empties himself, who teaches us an ethic of being blessed by being the least or by being the servants or by bringing peace, that this is the blessed life. He models this. And then when the world tries to stifle that voice, they find that they cannot. That he resurrects, it's indestructible, it remains. And the author of Hebrews is telling us that's your hope there. That's who you put your trust in. And when we reach this place where we realize that we're inadequate, that we can't do it, that in some ways this is what the law was there to do. To not only cast vision, but lead us to a place of frustration. And this is an interesting idea. I just learned a term this morning from Corey Kelso where she talked about this idea of optimal frustration. I think God holds out the law and he goes, hey, give it your best shot. And we're like, I can't do it. He's like, okay, good, right? That energy of like, but I can't do this. I'm not enough. And he would go, good. That we take back our power. And then in the end, what do we do with that? We surrender it. We yield it. If we stay over here and just pretend to be the victim all the time, we never grow, right? We take back that responsibility. That's the value of self-help. This is on you, right? You are the one at the end of your life that is going to realize the regrets or the need for forgiveness, right? That you are the one that's going to like look at your life with that responsibility. Jesus is saying, take that, but ultimately realize you are not enough to fix that. The Mel Robbins book says, let them, right? And she would say the beauty of that is that it says, let me. But let me do what? And I think Jesus says, let me. Or we might say, let him. We get to this place and with our responsibility, we surrender. That becomes the effort. That becomes the work. I think this is what Paul's talking about in Philippians 2, where he says, therefore, my dear brothers, just as you have always obeyed, so now not only in my presence, but even more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. There's the like taking back responsibility. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who is working in you both to will and work according to his good purpose. And you're like, oh yeah, here. Right, you take this. Hebrews 7:25 says, therefore, he's able to save completely those who come to God through him, since he always lives to intercede for them. I love this idea that we get weak, we stumble, we sleep. And Jesus is saying, I never do. Psalm 121:3-4 says, he will not allow your foot to slip. Your protector will not slumber. Indeed, the protector of Israel does not slumber or sleep. He's like constantly there saying, let me carry this with you. As we come into a new year and we bring these goals and we're like, I don't have what it takes. He's like, you don't, but here's the opportunity that we come to God and we say, give me bigger visions for my life. Ones that only you can make happen. In 1 Corinthians 2:9, it says, what no eye has seen, nor ear has heard, nor human heart has conceived, God has prepared these things for those who love him. This is the beautiful thing that God is going like, it's bigger than that. What are your goals, right? Without this sort of telos, without this sense of God's perfection, we're like, I want to make a lot of money, or I want a bigger house, or I want to feel more successful, or I want to attain all these things. And God's like, oh, too small, too small. Right? Bigger than that. Like a heart like his. God, I want to have the same heart that you do. He's like, yes. I want to think the way you do. God, make me wise. He's like, yes. God, make me more loving. Make me more like you. He's like, that's the plan. But you can't do it on your own. Stop trying. Let him do it. Self-help will never be enough, just like the law is not enough. That we need a priest who also is our shepherd, who walks with us, who intercedes for us, who never sleeps. This becomes the offer. This is the invitation. Jesus is going to say, yoke yourself to me. My burden is easy. That our efforts on our own are never deep enough. They never take us far enough. But what Jesus has given us is this opportunity to become like Christ. What Paul calls transformation. Jesus is going to say, you're my disciples, meaning you can do what I do. Those kind of goals. I wonder if we have the courage to dream that big. This would be my hope for us as a church, that we're stepping more and more fully into this promise. As our text says today, this is the guarantee that Jesus gives, this indestructible life. And that word in the Greek is probably less guarantee and more guarantor. That Jesus says, as your priest, I'll co-sign on the deed. As we get to the end of our life and go, is this enough? Jesus is like, my name is next to yours. I've done it and proven myself indestructible, perfect. I have what it takes to get you there. I thought I would close with I've got some questions. But before I do, to me, one of the things that Lewis wrote that I think is just so beautiful in this, it comes from this book called Man vs. Rabbit. And it really is on this idea of like, can't we live a moral life on our own? And he says this, the people who keep on asking if they can't lead a decent life without Christ don't really know what life is about. If they did, they would know that a decent life is mere machinery compared with the thing we men are really made for. Morality is indispensable, but the divine life, which gives itself to us and which calls us to be gods, intends for us something in which morality will be swallowed up. We are to be remade. All the rabbit in us is to disappear. That's like the lower sensual creature. The worried, conscientious, ethical rabbit, as well as the cowardly and sensual rabbit. We shall bleed and squeal as the handfuls of fur come out. And then surprisingly, we shall find underneath it all, the thing we have never yet imagined. A real man, an ageless God, a son of God, strong, radiant, wise, beautiful, and drenched in joy. And I mean, it's important to notice when he says an ageless God, that G is lowercase. We become in his image, not God himself. And yet something beyond which most of us really ever could fathom. And that's what Paul is saying. That's what God desires. Glory, so much more than our simple little ambitions. Here's my questions for you. As you look ahead at the coming year, I said, spend some time thinking of your eulogy and how the inevitable end of your life might be speaking into your goals and values for the coming year. How does this thought of your life as an ice cube change or motivate your directions for the coming year? That idea, considering the end, I'm in a week or less than a week doing a memorial for Patty's grandma, you know, and to sit there with this eulogy, but to think of your own in that moment, that inevitable moment, what do you long for people to say? Are there voices you're listening to that are keeping your story too small? Are there others' opinions that you are trying desperately to control? What would it be like to simply let them? There's my little Mel Robbins. That's not the Bible. That's just Mel Robbins. But maybe it is in the Bible, this idea of just not being concerned with those voices of criticism or judgment, or your own voices of judgment. What it would be like to take back that control. And lastly, do you have goals that are too big? How might you envision goals for next year that require faith in God's provision, not just your own talent and strengths? To sit with God and say, God, what are the goals? Let God speak into those things. God wants to show you those things. No eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor mind can comprehend what God has in store for those who love him.